Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.
Want to connect with a family member who doesn't speak your language? Then check out the language learning program Rosetta Stone on desktop or as an app. Rosetta Stone is designed to immerse you in the language you're learning through an intuitive process. Plus, the True Accent feature even gives you feedback on your pronunciation. And with a lifetime membership, you have access to all 25 offered languages. Get started today. Visit rosettastone.com/pod50 to get 50% off your lifetime membership now. That's rosettastone.com/pod50 for 50% off.
Welcome to True Crime Garage. Wherever you are, whatever you are doing, thanks for listening. I'm your host, Nick, and with me is a man that learned everything he knows from a one Ben Kenobi. The Force is strong with this one. He is the captain.
May the Force be with you all. It's good to be seen, and it's good to see you.
It's good to see you, Captain. Vacations? The sponsors said there will be no vacations, so we're back at it again here in the garage today. This week we are drinking Lake Erie Monster by the Great Lakes Brewing Company. Garage grade, 3 3/4 bottle caps out of 5. Lake Erie Monster is an unfiltered Imperial India Pale Ale with huge hop flavor. Lake Erie Monster was captured and brought to the garage by these outstandingly wonderful peeps. First we have Hope in New South Wales, Australia.
Like your jib.
Next we have Jason in Roberts, Wisconsin.
Like your jib.
Jason says he likes the show because we add some hops to the true crime stories, yet remain respectful of the victims and their families. Next up, you do not have to put on the red light. Roxanne. We have Roxanne in down in Austin, Texas. I'm sure she's never heard that one before,
Roxanne.
Captain. Next, we have Caddy in Atlanta. We also have Fanny in Sweden. And we want to say hi to Albert in Concord, California. Mm-hmm. Let's go up north. We have Sam in Alberta, Canada. And last but not least, we have Melissa from Oceanside, California. Melissa says the captain can sing sweet murder lullabies to her anytime. I don't know what
that means.
That's
just a little too creepy for me.
I don't think they write murder lullabies, do they?
Well, maybe they should. Anyways, thanks for the support. Thanks for donating. And you can do so by going to our website, truecrimegarage.com. Click on the donate banner. And we get to fill up the refrigerator in the garage. And like always, we like your jib.
So welcome to season 4, Captain. You know, last week we joked around at the end of season 3 that we were going to take this big long break. And
2.5 years.
We thought that everybody would get it. And we want to be out there working hard for you guys because we know you are out there working hard. You're commuting. You're listening to the show. You're doing your part. We're in the garage doing our part. So,
yeah, are you doing chores around the house? However you listen to the show.
We like your jib.
We like your jib.
For all things True Crime Garage, go to truecrimegarage.com. And for social media, check us out at True Crime Garage.
And that's enough for the business.
That's right. Gather around, grab a chair, grab a beer, and let's talk some true crime. This is True Crime Garage. And this is the case of Beverly Potts. Beverly Rose Potts. Age, 10 years old. Height, 4'11". And weight, about 90 pounds. Classification, endangered missing. Missing since August 24th, 1951, from Cleveland, Ohio. Beverly is a Caucasian female with blonde hair and blue eyes. She had her hair cut as a short bob with bangs. She was wearing blue denim jeans and a reddish-pink turtleneck jersey with a navy blue poplin jacket and brown Caribrook sport shoes loafers. The last confirmed sighting of Beverly was at 9:30 p.m. at Hollerin Park. She was last seen walking in the direction of her home. Beverly Rose Potts, age 10 years old, height 4'11", and weight about 90 pounds. Classification, endangered missing. Missing since August 24th, 1951, from Cleveland, Ohio. This is True Crime Garage. And this is the case of Beverly Potts. This is Friday, August 24th, 1951. Beverly Potts is 10 years old, and she's living with her mom, dad, and sister on Lynette Avenue in Cleveland, Ohio. Now, this is on the west side of Cleveland, and it's summertime. So Beverly, she is enjoying the last few weeks of her summer break before she returns to school. She was due to enter the fifth grade that year. Beverly is quite excited about the weekend. She has already had some plans scheduled. She's planned to go with her sister and mother and father on Saturday. Beverly's sister lived, as we said, at the home with the family, but she was quite a bit older than Beverly. Beverly's sister, Anita, was 22 years old at the time, and the two of them lived with the parents, and they were going to go to Euclid Beach Park for an all-day outing on that Saturday.
So that's like a 12-year difference, so... She's probably like an accidental baby.
Possibly. But to add to her excitement, that Friday afternoon, Beverly had learned that the show wagon was coming to nearby Hollerin Park. Now, the show wagon is sponsored by the Recreation League and the Cleveland Press, and it was a kind of a summer tradition. The show wagon was a group of singers, dancers, musicians.
Musicians.
And magicians. I kind of just rolled those words together.
You made up a new word.
And other performers that traveled around to Cleveland, to the different neighborhoods in Cleveland in the summer months, doing free performances at local playgrounds and other public venues.
So it's kind of like an arts festival type thing.
Yeah, and this had become one of Beverly's favorite summertime activities. Now, on this Friday, Beverly was excited, of course, but she was also a little bit nervous because she was going to need to ask permission to go to this performance. And she was currently in trouble with her parents. Mm-hmm. Her mother had grounded her from going to Hollerin Park for 2 weeks because she had went there earlier and she had stayed out much later than she was allowed to. Mm-hmm. But even though she was grounded, her mother is going to let her go see the show wagon. And Beverly is going to go with her best friend and next door neighbor, Patricia Swing.
Well, this is around the time... I mean, even in the 80s, it was kind of a thing. So I'm assuming this was kind of the same thing in the 50s, where your parents would say, yeah, go out with your friends, ride your bikes, do whatever you got to do. But hey, when the streetlights come on, get home. Mm-hmm. Or even before that, once you start seeing that it's getting dark, get home.
And not only for, you know, for the teenagers, but for some of the younger kids as well, this is also kind of a social event, right? Because you go there and there's going to be other kids your age. You haven't seen some of those kids because of the summer break.
Right.
You catch up with them. You say hi. Maybe you hope to see the boy or the girl that you like, or, you know, some friends that you haven't seen all summer long. After dinner, Beverly is helping her mother clean up and dry the dishes. And for her efforts, her mother, Elizabeth, gives Beverly a nickel for helping out. Around 7 p.m., Beverly and Patricia leave to go off to the park to see the show wagon. Now, they leave their homes on their bikes, and Holleran Park is only about an eighth of a mile from their homes on Lynette Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
Holleran Park stretches for about three blocks from West 117th to West 120th Avenue.
Yeah, but when you're like 10 years old, 12 years old, 15, you know, all that stuff, before you can drive, your bike is a big deal. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's your
means of transportation.
Right.
So this is the park itself is a 13-acre civic recreational area with baseball diamonds, basketball courts, trapeze bars, and a shelter house. The park was named for William Holleran, who was a sailor that was killed on the USS Arizona at Pearl Harbor.
Aye, aye, Captain.
So the girls leave for the park on their bikes, but it's estimated that there were about 1,500 people at the park that evening. So the girls want to get off their bikes and get a good spot so they can see the performance. Well, they decide that it's going to be very difficult to watch the performance and all the while keeping an eye on their bicycles. So they go home and they leave their bikes and return to Holleran Park on foot. They arrive at the park around 8 p.m. Patricia would later report that the two young girls didn't really talk to very many people while they were there. So this was something they thought might be a social event, and it didn't turn out to be very social for them. They arrived at 8 p.m. Now, around 8:40 p.m., it's starting to get dark out, and Patricia is trying to get Beverly to leave and go home, as Patricia is supposed to be home by dark. Like the captain said, make sure you're home by dark. It's starting to get dark, and she wants to leave, but Beverly informs her that she has been given permission to stay until the performance is over. I'm guessing her parents probably didn't know exactly how late this would go. Because we're talking about two young girls that are, you know, roughly 10 years old.
Yeah, it sounds like Beverly is trying to stay out on a technicality.
Yeah, and she's already gotten in trouble for doing this once, so maybe this is something she's pretty good at. But she tells Patricia, you know, I'm allowed to stay until this whole thing's over. So Patricia leaves. You know, she doesn't want to get in trouble with her parents. She decides to go home, leaving her friend to enjoy the show wagon performance by herself. Patricia started walking home, and her last memory of Beverly is of her standing there watching the show with a plump little woman. This is the young girl's words. A plump little woman standing behind her with one hand on her shoulder and the other holding a small child. I've got to cut in here for a second because I always found this to be...
You're going to cut in on yourself?
I'm going to cut in. I got to interrupt myself. I always found this to be weird because they said that they didn't talk to...
I always found you weird.
Talk to hardly anybody while they were there.
Mm-hmm.
And yet she sees this woman standing behind her friend... With the hand on the shoulder, so this must be somebody she knows or feels comfortable with, and the plump little woman is holding a small child in the other hand. It always intrigued me that this was somebody that Patricia says she didn't speak to, and she didn't recognize, obviously didn't know the person's name if she's just giving a description of the woman.
But is it clear that, I mean, you say the hand is on a shoulder, you didn't say the hand is on Beverly's shoulder.
That's what it sounds like from Patricia's account, that the woman had her hand on Beverly's shoulder.
Yeah, that's odd.
Mm-hmm. It's again, seeing how they didn't supposedly talk to anybody that evening. Beverly's family, they are at home, as we said, an eighth of a mile away. Patricia arrives home safely. She's the next door neighbor. She arrives home safely at 9 p.m., and she never sees her friend Beverly again after that. Now, the family is watching. This is Beverly's family. They're at home, all of them. It's the father, Robert, mother, Elizabeth, and the older sister, Anita. They are at home watching the Indians-Yankees game. This is, I would imagine this is probably what a lot of people, what a lot of the grownups were doing that evening, because we know how big baseball is in Cleveland, and we all know how much the Clevelanders dislike the New York Yankees. And I think they were in a pretty heated race that year.
I wonder if they're actually watching or if they're actually just listening to it on the radio.
Well, they were watching it because, you know, TVs were relatively new at the time. So I imagine most of the people that had a TV at the time would have been at home watching this game on that evening. It's around 9:30 and they're starting to get nervous because they've not seen Beverly. She's not returned. So they have Anita. Anita, the older sister, calls the Swing household and asks about Beverly. And she's told, you know, yeah, Patricia came home, but she came home alone. And she's been here for, you know, a little over half an hour now. And we don't know where Beverly is. Now,
well, here's what's weird, too, is if they rode their bikes there first and then they went back to Beverly's house, right, to drop off the bikes. So then her friend doesn't go back and pick up her bike. She just walks home?
Well, they live next door. So presumably they went home and returned their bikes to their houses and then left immediately.
I wasn't clear on that. Okay.
Yeah, I said they were neighbors, but they were actually next door neighbors.
Right. So they're also kind of friends by proximity. Right?
Yeah. Age and proximity. This raises the alarm. Okay, because now their daughter's not home, but they're extremely worried because now they know that she's probably alone and that her friend, you know, strength in numbers, right, is now returned home and Beverly's not there. So Mr. Potts decides he's going to go to the park and he's going to look for his daughter. And he would gather up a couple neighbors to go to the park with him. As we said, this park is roughly 13 acres, so it's fairly decent size. And it's dark out now. And I've also read some descriptions of the neighborhood stating that they had several large trees, like lots of large trees on the streets of these neighborhoods. So even though they had street lights, they said that the park and the streets themselves were particularly dark because those trees covered up a lot of the lighting.
Yeah. You'll see that now of days when they build like a new housing development. Like it seems pretty bright and you can see everything because the trees aren't mature yet. And then once that neighborhood becomes mature, you realize, wow, this really gets a lot darker than it once was.
Yeah. Yeah. So Mr. Potts and some of the neighbors, they search the park looking for Beverly. And after searching for about an hour or so, they call the police. So we have things happening at a very quick pace here. You know, we have the girls arrive at the park around 8. Patricia leaves around 8:40. She's at home close to 9 o'clock. 9:30, the family realizes that Beverly's not where she should be, and within an hour of 9:30, the father, along with a few other people, have searched the park and they've called the police, and the police are quick to respond.
So now we have this 10-year-old, you know, that went missing. She just went to this event. Her parents can't find her, so they go looking for her. They get the police involved, and now we got to start figuring out all the little details. And they start normally by, you know, the description of the individual.
Yeah, typically they're going to want the parents to tell them as much as they can about the child, what they were last seen wearing, what they left the house in.
Well, and the fact that, you know, she just left the house a little bit ago. So it's not like she left for school in the morning and we haven't seen her since. What was she wearing? I can't remember. I mean, she left the house, you know, under 2 hours ago.
And we gave a description of her in the trailer, but there's a little more detail to it. So I'll go through that now. As we said, she's 10 years old, height and weight. She's about 4'11", 90 pounds. She's described as a Caucasian female with blonde hair, blue eyes. And she had recently cut her hair to a short bob with bangs shortly before the disappearance. Now, if you look up images of Beverly Potts, you will see the typical image that comes up first is of her where she appears to be a little bit younger and she has long hair. And because these are black and white photos, it appears that she has dark hair, but her description clearly says blonde hair. And then you'll see more recent photos of her with the shorter haircut. Some of her distinguishing characteristics, she has wide set eyes and gaps between her teeth, and her upper and lower molars have silver fillings in them. She has a vaccination scar on her upper left arm and a small scar over her left eyebrow, and a kidney-shaped birthmark about 1 inch long and 3/8 of an inch wide on her instep. Now, one thing that is often described about Beverly when you look up her case and look into her case is that she had a very distinctive walk. Okay. It's described as duck-like. You know, she kind of walked with her toes pointing outward. And this must have been very obvious to everyone because it's mentioned time and time again when they talk about her disappearance.
So she was opposite of the captain because the captain walked.
You walk pigeon-toed. Yeah. Yeah.
Nobody ever told me either.
So you never corrected it?
No.
As said, she had that distinctive walk where she would walk with her toes pointed out. She was considered tall for her age at the time of her disappearance. And now looking back, you know, they continue to give her description, you know, from time to time. And one thing that they've included, you know, years afterward would be that they suspect she would have grown to be a tall adult. Her clothing and jewelry description at the time that she went missing, she was believed to be wearing size 14 or 16 pants. These were girls' blue denim jeans with the side zipper and a bright red cotton panties with no tag and elastic around the waist, but no elastic around the leg holes. She was wearing green socks, a white cotton Honey Lane under t-shirt with a tag, a reddish pink turtleneck jersey with no label, a navy blue poplin jacket with no label, both pockets torn, size 5 or 5.5, brown Kerrybrook sport shoes. These are loafer style shoes, which had been resoled and healed. She also had two metal hair clasps with a brown plastic covers and a yellow gold ring. This ring is similar to like a wedding ring, and it has spaces for 7 or 8 small stones, but the stones were all missing.
Right, so probably something that a family member had, and they just handed it to her, and she was just happy to have that little ring as a 10-year-old. So I wonder if they knew all this information based on, like, I mean, it is, what, 51?
Yeah.
Right, so, you know, the mom's probably laying out your clothes. I mean, that you kind of go through that as a child. It's like you wake up and there's like an outfit laid out for you, you know, and then you turn 16 and you stop wearing those outfits.
Well, and you know, when I first came across this case and looked into it, I thought the description of her clothes was very strange because it's very specific. I mean, even down, like they're a little.
The no tag thing is weird. Did the mom pull out tags of things?
Yeah,
maybe that's
that's what I'm guessing, because I found it strange that the size of the pants were either 14 or 16. But then we go into details whether we know what clothing had tags and what didn't have a tag. However, when I got to thinking about it, you know, not every size 14 is the same 14 for every pair of pants or every make of pants.
Right.
So she may have wore 14 of ones and 16s of others. But as you said, the no tag thing is a little bit weird. And I always found it very strange that the bright red cotton panties were listed there. But now,
again, like if the mom is helping her pick out outfits.
And I think that's probably exactly what was going on, because Mr. Potts, he was a stagehand. He had a full-time job. Mm-hmm. And Elizabeth Potts, his wife, she was a stay-at-home. She was a homemaker, stay-at-home mom.
Yeah, which is more common back then.
Yeah, so she probably had a very good idea of exactly what the girl was wearing, because as the captain said, she might have been responsible for setting these clothes out for Beverly in the morning time, or, you know, she was probably up on the laundry, you know, what's getting washed when and when things are getting used and making sure that her daughter is dressed appropriately. So I do commend the parents for being able to provide such a detailed description, because sometimes when children go missing, there are valuable minutes and hours lost because sometimes people don't have an up-to-date picture of their child, or they don't have a great idea of what the kid may have been wearing that day, or, you know, these little details do matter. And when you're trying to piece them together and provide the police with information, you could lose valuable time here trying to recall these things and kind of asking others, you know, what was she wearing?
Yeah, and if you don't pay attention to what, like you said, what she's wearing when she left for this event, and then, you know, she's wearing some jacket that they find later, and you have, is this her jacket? I don't know. I have no clue.
Right.
And then that's where is this jacket a lead or not? So, yeah, I mean, it's very important kind of mental checks of that stuff.
So that's a more in-depth, more detailed description of the items that she was wearing and her distinguishing characteristics. And now we are on to the search.
Before the search, let's take a quick break.
The evidence keeps pouring in. At this point, the facts are undeniable. It's an open and shut case. Monopoly Go is the most fun you can have in a mobile game. Everyone is still talking about Monopoly Go for a good reason. It is an absolute hit. Millions of people pass Go every day because this game is always bringing something new to the table, like countless crazy tournaments you can join with your friends as partners or teams, or timed events offering bonuses like massive multipliers or rent frenzies to help you get huge rewards. And there's so many rewards to discover. Rare stickers you can trade with friends to complete albums. Delightful emojis to taunt people with when you raid their riches. Unique playing pieces and so much more. The verdict is in. With Monopoly Go, there's something new to discover every time you play. So don't miss out. Go download it now free on the App Store and Google Play.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different stressors, big and small. When we keep them bottled up, it can start to affect us negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to work through whatever's weighing you down.
If you're thinking of starting therapy, I highly recommend that you give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/garage today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/garage. This show is proudly sponsored by BetterHelp. Check out BetterHelp.com/garage today.
The best part of spring cleaning takeaway is the post-clean clarity you get. It's kind of like when you find out that you've been paying a fortune for wireless. When Mint Mobile has phone plans for $15 a month when you purchase a 3-month plan. It's time to switch to Mint Mobile. All plans come with high-speed data and unlimited talk and text delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. Use your own phone with any Mint Mobile plan and bring your phone number along with all of your existing contacts. Ditch overpriced wireless with Mint Mobile's limited time deal and get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. Save a lot of money with Mint Mobile. Get their great mobile wireless service delivered on the nation's largest 5G network. That's premium service at a great price. To get this new customer offer and your new 3-month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, go to mintmobile.com/TCG. That's mintmobile.com/TCG. Cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/TCG. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3-month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details.
Everyone loves a good family mystery, especially one with as many twists and turns as June's Journey, a hidden object mystery game with a captivating detective story. It takes you back to the glamour of the 1920s with a diverse cast of characters. You'll step into the role of June Parker and search for hidden clues to uncover the mystery of her sister's murder. Use your observation skills to quickly uncover key pieces of information that lead to chapters of mystery, danger, and romance. And customize your very own luxurious estate island Think expansive gardens and beautiful buildings. Collect scraps of information to fill your photo album and learn more about each character. And you can chat and play with or against other players by joining a detective club. Can you crack the case? Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android.
Break. All right, that's a nice word from the sponsors. And if it wasn't for them, we would have took off 2.5 years.
That's right.
So, all right. Cheers, everybody.
Cheers. So where we left off, we're at the start of our search and investigation for the disappearance of Beverly Rose Potts. Now, this would end up going down in history as one of the largest searches for a missing person in the Cleveland, Ohio history. Within hours, there are thousands of Clevelanders that are searching for this girl. The postal carriers are given a description of Beverly, and posters with her picture are going up on utility poles and windows all over the city.
Yeah, and with that, within hours, but you know, basically the start of the next day.
Exactly.
She went missing at night.
Exactly. Now, there were a lot of eyewitnesses, a lot of supposed eyewitnesses in this case. Mm-hmm. As we had said, there were about 1,500 people present at the park that evening. Now, unfortunately, out of those 1,500 people, out of those 1,500, there were not a lot that came forward with information to the police regarding having seen Beverly Potts, mm-hmm, or know her whereabouts, or if they had seen her with somebody else. So what the police end up doing is, we had said this was late August. Well, school was starting for these children in September. Now, the police don't know everybody that was in attendance at the park that evening. So one thing that they do is they start going to Beverly School when school starts up in September to interview a lot of the kids that were her age to find out if they were in fact at the park that evening, and if they were, if they had seen anything. Now, they get a lot of stories from these kids.
Yeah, I mean, I would assume this presents a problem.
This ends up,
because, first of all,
cheers.
Cheers. No, but I think this would present a big problem because you're now asking kids to remember an event that happened weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And whether they were there or not, some people will just come forward because they want to be a part of the process and say that there were somewhere that they weren't at ever. So,
right. Right. Well, and picture these kids. These are young kids that they're interviewing, right?
Yeah, Beverly was 10 years old.
Yeah, they're interviewing 9, 10, 11-year-old kids. And a lot of them had probably heard about this, mm-hmm, before they went back to school. And they're young. They don't really understand the situation and what's going on. Now, as said, there were thousands of Clevelanders out looking for this girl. So there's no way that they probably didn't hear about it. And in fact, a few days after her disappearance, there was a front page editorial that was entitled, "Let's All Help Look for the Missing Child." Mm-hmm. You know, so this was going on throughout the entire city. Everybody was aware of this. Now, when they sit down and they start talking to these kids, they are finding out that, you know, these are kids and teenagers, and the police figure out early into the goings on here that they need to be hesitant about some of the stories that they are hearing. In fact, a lot of these stories were, they're hearing them, and they're, as they're writing them down and taking their notes, they're going, well, this is not a likely story. This,
right.
Everything I'm hearing right now probably didn't happen. You know, and in most of the cases, these ended up being proven lies that they were hearing from the children. You know, some of these kids, they wanted, mm-hmm, they may have wanted the attention, or some of them wanted to be a part of the whole thing. As we said, this was a very big story.
And maybe not flat out lies, but just, you know, misspeaking or, you know, or misremembering. I mean, I don't think the kids' intentions were, you know, there was no malice behind it.
No, I agree. But you also have to keep in mind, too, maybe these kids, you know, were you at a park August 24th, you know, and you're 9 or 10 or 11 years old and being asked this a week or two later. Kids don't right. remember where they were 2 weeks before. And on top of that, you know, did you see Beverly Potts with anybody? Have you seen Beverly Potts since then? Maybe they don't know exactly who she is. And then, well, she's a girl about your age and she's about this height. And then, you know, kids, I think, naturally want to be helpful.
Well, we have evidence, though. I mean, we have evidence that Beverly went to this park often. She was grounded before from going to this park and staying out too late. So we can just assume that this is a park that's frequented by the children that mm-hmm. live in that area. Mm-hmm. So did you see her at the park? Yes, I did. But was it that day? Right. Maybe not.
Right. Right. And again, if they didn't know who she was and they're going, oh, yeah, I did see a little girl that night. And maybe I was at the park that exact night that you're asking me about. But there were 1,500 people there. There were a lot of little girls there. And at some point, Beverly Potts becomes the only important girl there that evening. And did you see her? Yes, I saw a little girl and I saw her do this or that. One of the eyewitnesses, and we won't go through all of them. As we said, there's so many that were just bad leads. And unfortunately, the police had to follow up on most of them if they were unable to determine if it was a lie or just a made up story immediately. But one of the eyewitnesses was a 9-year-old girl. She had said that she saw Beverly Potts get into a green car with two boys in it. Now, this sounds like a good lead. However, no one else reported having seen this take place. And the boys themselves could not be identified by the eyewitness. And she was not able to provide a decent description of the vehicle or the boys themselves. Mm-hmm. But that gives you an example of some of the eyewitness accounts that they were getting from the school-aged children. Now, maybe the last person to see Beverly, well, other than, you know, her murderer or abductor, as we could probably assume by now, was Fred Krause. Now, he's a 13-year-old boy, and he recalled seeing Beverly at around 9:30.
Okay.
This would have been after the show wagon performance had ended, and everybody was kind of leaving the park at this time. And he said that he saw Beverly, and this is one account that they believe to be true, because he said some things, mm-hmm. you know, details about this disappearance, where he says, you know, how did you know it was Beverly? He said, I knew it was her right away because she walked funny and was able to tell that it was her. He was actually riding home on his bicycle from the park that night. And he said that he had, you know, was coming down the street mm-hmm. and she kind of jumped out of his way so he could continue on his bike. Now, he saw her. This would have been around 9:30 after the performance had ended, and she was walking home alone. And the direction that he said she was heading would indicate to him and everybody else that she was, in fact, heading home.
Yeah, and this park, like we've mentioned multiple times, it's less than a mile. It's 0.8 yeah, miles away from our house.
It's an eighth of a mile. Yeah.
Okay, so really small window. And then he sees her at what distance? I mean, we could be talking that she went missing basically blocks from her house. And how many blocks? I mean, if he's, you know, it could have been one block from her house.
Right.
That's what's so crazy about a lot of disappearing, you know, cases. It's just, you know, 1 minute they're there, 1 minute they're gone. And the proximity to her house, that's crazy.
And I believe his account to be true because, one, he saw her within feet of her. You know, it wasn't across the way.
And he's roughly her age, so he would know who she was.
And he pointed out to the officers that he knew it was her, but he knew it was her from behind. He said when he came up on his bike, mm-hmm. he knew it was going to be her.
With her because, short hair.
Because she was walking funny. She had that,
oh, right,
that duck walk.
Right, and he's not saying, I saw a girl. He's saying, I saw Beverly.
Exactly.
That's a big difference.
Exactly. Now, another thing that came into play here that was bad for the police and bad for the investigation was 2 months after Beverly's disappearance, a man called the family. Now, I need to set this up a little bit better here, okay? Because at the time of her disappearance, they were receiving tips. And when I say they, I mean the police and the Potts family.
Right.
They're receiving tips that are being called into the police station and to the Potts family's household as well.
And you'll see later on, I mean, this is 1951, so I don't know if they tapped the Potts family house. or not, but that's something you'll see later. I mean, if you think about the JonBenet Ramsey case, you know, the girl goes missing, then they set up, they start wiretapping the house for any leads that might come in or some suspicious calls. But yeah, so, and this is also 1951 where people's numbers are normally listed.
Mm-hmm. And the cruel thing here is, I'm going to fast forward past this incident for just a second, but the cruel thing here is eventually the Potts family, they were in the phone book, and eventually they had to make their number unlisted,
right?
Because they were receiving harassing phone calls and menacing phone calls, you know, people taunting them at some point with pranksters.
That's ridiculous.
This would take place, I think it might have been a year or so after the disappearance that they had to unlist
phone
number.
I mean, think about some sicko is just sitting there with their number deciding, I got this prank to pull on the family. And mm-hmm. and it could have been anything. I mean, what are you thinking? Like, you know, like, all I have her, we want the ransom, or all I saw her, but I didn't see her. I mean, because there's also that, Kate, that stuff happens too, you know, where a girl goes missing and some crazy loon that has no freaking life is sitting there going, well, what if I call them and tell them I saw her? Mm-hmm. Then I get to talk to somebody. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
There's sickos out there.
Well, and you know, there was a journalist and an investigator that I read about regarding this case specifically that said that for some reason the disappearance of Beverly Potts brought out every nut pot and nutcracker out of the woodwork,
right?
Because they were receiving
so
many
nutcracker.
I think I, right. Yeah,
I said nutcracker earlier, and that's
it slipped in there. But they were receiving so many calls, and they estimate that they were receiving about 1,000 phone calls a day between the Potts household and the police department. Now, this makes it very hard to investigate this case, but one such incident was this. This was 2 months after the disappearance. As I said, a man had called the family and demanded a $25,000 ransom for the safe return of Beverly Potts.
Okay.
And he said that we have your daughter, and that if we do not get the $25,000 ransom, mm-hmm. we are going to slit her throat. So now a threat is made, a ransom is demanded. And the way that this was to go down is that the family was to deliver, they're not to involve the police, right? They are to deliver the
That's
cash.
How it always goes down, right? Don't, if you tell the police, we're going to kill her. That's normally what happens.
Yeah, I think that's pretty standard ransom template.
Yeah, but how many times do the parents then just call the police?
Yeah, can you imagine being in that situation to do, you know?
Yeah,
my gut would say get the police involved. I think, you know, I don't know that, well, I would Mel Gibson it and just, is that the Mel Gibson movie
ransom.
Where he just does it on his own?
Yeah, but that's the strange thing too. I mean, you know, being a parent, if you're a parent and you get this call and we have your daughter and obviously you want her home safe and you just want this nightmare to be over with. And don't contact the police. Wouldn't there be like, I mean, your gut instinct is, okay, let's call the police. But isn't there a part of you going, what do these people know? Mm-hmm. And are they going to know I contacted the police? And in how many cases was there a ransom? A parent contacted the police and then that ended up causing the death of the child.
Right.
You know, and then... you know, the regret that you'd feel of that.
Well, presumably, you know, one would think that the ransom is only as good as the living, you know, person that I'm holding to give back in favor
right,
for the
right.
money. If I kill the victim or the hostage, then I'm not going to receive my ransom. But I see what you're saying. These things get screwed up and they go wrong. Now, the Potts family did let the police know about this ransom that was called in.
Okay.
And what they were told, you know, they were told with the threat about the daughter's life, but they were told to deliver $25,000 in cash to a specific address that was not terribly far from their neighborhood. Now, they involved the police.
Right, which the park is not far from the neighborhood. So now you're making this connection where, well, this is now something that might be likely.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Potts family, they lived in a decent area. It was a regular middle-class family, but it's not one that you would look at this family and assume that they got a bunch of money to just pay out for to have their child returned. What they end up doing is one of the detectives, he dresses up like Mrs. Potts. Because Mrs. Potts was the one that was told to deliver the money.
Right, right.
So he puts on like this, I don't know, like a trench coat or like a fur coat, you know, something that that looks like a women's coat. And he ties his hair up, you know, with the...
Well, guys don't wear fur coats.
Some of them do. You know, but this looked like Mayweather, a woman's coat.
Conor McGregor.
Joe Namath.
These are three guys that like to wear fur coats.
And so he dressed himself up to appear to be a woman. Now, I've seen pictures of this man dressed.
I'm sorry to laugh, but
I've seen him dressed as a woman, and he's kind of a larger, big hands, athletic looking man that I don't know that he would have passed for Elizabeth Potts.
Don't look at me. I'm hideous.
Well, apparently, whomever he was to deliver the money to picked up on this and saw the detective coming.
Yeah, well, when you see a guy that looks like a linebacker and a fur coat, you start going, well, I don't know. And if this person lived in the area, then we could also assume if this is a legitimate ransom note, a legitimate kidnapping, that this person probably knew of the Potts' family and what the lady looked like. The only thing that gets a little weird about this is, like we said, she was a tall kid. So maybe the mother was a tall lady herself. But again, she probably didn't look like a linebacker.
Right.
With sausage fingers. You know, giant sausage fingers coming at you and you're going, wait a second.
Well, and it turns out that this man that was seeking the ransom, he didn't actually live at the address that he was requesting them to go to. He gave them a specific date, specific time to give the money, hand it off to this person.
Well, what's so crazy is, you know, criminals are normally stupid. So it wouldn't baffle me or blow my mind if you told me, oh, he actually lived there, you know, he did the smarter thing as a criminal to just give you some address, you know.
So the detective dresses up like Mrs. Potts, and they fill a bag. This is to be the money bag that he's going to hand off. They fill the bag with shredded newspaper and a single $5 bill, which I'm not certain why they included any money at all. But I don't know. Maybe if they had to open up the bag and you want them to see some kind of money.
Right.
But $5 is as much as they could scrape together for this sting operation.
But, you know, being a banker, you know, I was a vault teller. So what would happen is normally Tuesdays, they'd come in with a big bag of money, right? And they'd drop off the bag of money. Then I have to count all the money to make sure that we got the correct amount of money from the money service. And you'd be surprised. Sometimes you'd just, you know, order hundreds and fifties and, you know, 10 grand would look tiny, you know, or 100,000 could look just like a brick. You know, so in these movies where they open up a suitcase and it's just filled, you know, and it looks like, oh, this is $100,000. Like, I've seen $100,000, and depending on what denomination of money it comes in, it can be quite small.
Right.
And you start looking like that $100,000 you can slip in your pocket and maybe, you know, invest that into some recording equipment and start a podcast. I'm not saying that happened. I'm just saying that it's a possibility.
The man that is to receive the money, he knows something is going on here when he sees the person that is supposed to be Elizabeth Potts walking toward the address to give him the money.
Okay, so I'm just making this clear for myself. So the guy that is supposedly holding this girl for ransom is now suspicious of the linebacker in the fur coat.
Right.
The linebacker with the sausage fingers and the fur coat is now suspicious of the ransom guy because this girl that is walking with him that is supposed to be Beverly.
No. Okay. No. I think you misunderstood me. It gets confusing because I keep referring to the detective who's dressed as a woman as a she once in a while.
Okay.
There is actually no she in this situation.
Okay.
The detective is supposed to be Elizabeth Potts, the mother.
Okay.
Because the ransom person did not want any males around, did not want Mr. Potts delivering the money because Mr. Potts might be able to overtake him,
right.
And take the guy down. So he requests that Elizabeth Potts bring the money to this address at this time on this date.
Okay.
The detective dresses up as a woman.
Right.
Trying to look like Mrs. Potts. Mm. He's going there with the bag of cut up newspaper and a $5 bill.
Right.
And before he can get to the address, the man that is waiting there
okay.
freaks out because this does not look like a woman.
Right. He's a linebacker.
And so he takes off on foot.
Okay.
And what ends up happening is the detective ends up chasing the guy down and he makes an arrest.
Yeah. Good for him.
They're able to figure out after talking to the guy and going through the guy's home and his vehicles and things like that, that this guy had nothing to do with the disappearance of Beverly Potts.
Right. Just again, a sicko getting involved and maybe trying to go, hey, I got this great idea to get $25,000.
You're exactly right. He was a guy that was heavily in debt. He saw what he thought of as an opportunity, and he took that opportunity to try to extort money from parents of a missing child.
Yeah.
And of course he ends up getting,
you know, they should tack on years for that.
You're exactly right.
You know, I believe not only was your crime stupid, but you know, you're now affecting a grieving family and a grieving community, and you're wasting taxpayers' time and money by getting this linebacker to wear a fur coat and chase your ass down and tackle you. We're going to tack on 3 years.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you're preventing justice from taking place because you're getting involved in the investigation and you're taking up the police's time that they could be out. You know, they're 1,000 calls a day. They had other calls to go out on. And this is a sting operation. This isn't something that they just threw together in 5 minutes. They probably spent a little bit of time coming up with what is our best solution here. Do we actually send Elizabeth Potts with $25,000 and just hope that she gets her daughter back, or do we intervene? So he ends up getting charged with extortion and, you know, all kinds of other things, I'm sure. And I hope that in this situation, if they don't currently, they should, as the captain says, tack on extra years for that kind of shameful behavior. But this just shows you the things that the police had to deal with in this investigation.
Yeah.
But one thing I do want to bring up too here, Captain, is we talked about this ransom. Now, you know, for all the other true crime fans out there, the true crime lovers that spend their time reading and looking things up on the internet and reading these different books or watching old documentaries, you know that back in the day, and, you know, I'm referring to the 30s, 40s, 50s, back then it was more expected to receive a ransom than it is in current times. You know, unfortunately, in current times, when we see a child or an adult go missing, we either expect that they're going to turn up soon or that they've were taken and we might not hear from them again.
Right.
But back in the day, it was more commonplace to receive a ransom.
Probably a lot of them being false.
Well, you're onto something there, but a lot of them were in fact true. You know, a lot of people, this is how some of the poorer folks made some money.
Right.
You know, they would be out and they would abduct a wealthy person's child and return them unharmed in trade for 10 grand or 20 grand or whatever it was. That happened more often. But just like the captain said, because sometimes that doesn't happen, because sometimes people take another person for other reasons other than a ransom, that sometimes other people would just call in a ransom and hope to get something out of this tragedy. Usually in a situation, though, when a ransom is demanded, it's usually fairly quickly after the abduction. You know, it's not often that you see 2 months go by before the ransom comes about. And I think that this is the police doing good detective work and using their knowledge. And they probably presumed that this was not, may not end well. And that might be why they didn't advise the Potts family to actually pay the ransom. Maybe this is why they didn't advise Elizabeth Potts to go and hand off the money herself. And that's why they intervened.
So we got this lead just kind of comes to crash and we get this guy in jail now. But do we have any other good leads that like anything solid?
Well, another good bit of detective work that the police did was they did fully investigate the Potts family, you know, as difficult as that can be. But you do have to rule out the immediate family as quick as possible so you can go on to other possible suspects.
Well, yeah, but one, we don't have a body, right? We don't have a body, and we have three people at the house that it's not like, again, I'm going to bring up the JonBenet Ramsey case, but in that case, we have a dead girl. Why the family is all there? Mm-hmm. So they become, I think, more prime suspects than in this case.
Yeah, but the other thing, I just wanted to make sure I pointed that out too, because often we will hear, you know, you see this on Dateline or other shows where they're like, you know, this person went missing or so-and-so turned up dead.
Right.
And by the way, they didn't investigate the family until months and months after the fact.
Right, right, right.
This was not the case here. So there's no reason to believe that Mr. Potts or Mrs. Potts or her sister had anything to do with this crime at all.
It's a difficult situation for the cops to be in.
Yeah.
You know, because here's this girl going missing and it's tragic and there's a lot of emotions going and a lot of emotions that are there that are coming at the family. And then you have to then say, hey, I got to question you. Mm-hmm. What's your involvement?
And one thing that I've always done on my own when I'm looking at a missing person's case, with a missing child case, I should be very clear about this. But, you know, you can find these stories of missing children that have never surfaced, that we've never seen them ever again after that last time they were seen.
Right.
But one thing I always like to do when I'm looking at a case like that is I like to see what the parents did with their lives after the fact. Okay. Because I'll clue you, you know, I'll throw this at you. Like there was a case that took place in Michigan. Now this would have been in the late 80s, and we won't get into this whole case, but the short of it is the son went missing. Uh-huh. And I found the circumstances to be a little strange and maybe had a feeling maybe the father could have been involved in it because of where he was last seen and such things of that nature. The family moved away. Like they moved away like 9 or 10 months after the son had disappeared.
Yeah, which is weird because you would assume that, you know, if there's a chance of him coming home,
yeah,
you know, you want to give that, you know, a bunch of windows. And it's kind of like the Johnny Gosch case as well, too. Look at the path the mother took and the path that the father took. And a lot of people now speculate that the father was involved because of his actions afterwards. So same thing that you're doing.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, you see this time and time again where you have a child that's gone missing and they're missing for an extensive amount of time. And you might hear an interview with the parents 10 or 11 years later and they say, we've not moved. We've thought about moving because the memories are so hard for us to deal with, but we would not be able to live with ourselves if the chance that our daughter or son got away from whomever and tried to come home and we weren't there.
Right.
You know, if they didn't know any other means of contacting us, they wouldn't be able to live with themselves. So this was not the situation with the Potts family. I'll go ahead and throw that out there. The Potts family remained in the home for many, many years. And as said, they were cleared pretty quickly by the police. The other thing that the police did was they searched the neighborhoods because we know she was on foot. And the thought would have been, this is one thing that we didn't cover when we were talking about her characteristics. She was very shy and almost to the point of being afraid of men and older boys. They had said on multiple occasions, you know, if approached by a man or an older boy, mm-hmm. that she was likely to walk away or run away from a situation.
Okay.
And her parents had raised her to be, well, she was very obedient, one, and a polite young child, but they...
Yeah, and more, this is not common these days.
Yeah, and they had raised her as well to be weary of men and boys. So once the police had this information, they were immediately worried about this because she was not likely to go off with somebody. She didn't have that right. personality. So the police were working under a couple different theories. One, that she either was taken by somebody that knew her or that she somewhat knew. Or that she would have been lured into a vehicle or to a car, but it would most likely have to be somebody she was somewhat familiar with, that they didn't expect her to just get in a car with a random stranger.
Yeah, possibly, or by physical force.
Yeah, you know? And And she, I guess, even though being young, you know, even as young as she was known to have babysat for different neighbors in the area.
Right. So that would give her a bunch of connections and a bunch of possibilities of suspects, really.
And one police theory that they were working off of, that maybe she was coaxed into a house with the thought of maybe that being offered a babysitting job.
Yeah. Or just it's this, you know, dad of a kid that you watched multiple mm-hmm. times, and you're walking home and he just says, "Hey, Beverly, come in here for a second." And then, of course, he's not a stranger. And then you're also thinking, like, you know, this is somewhat my employer, so I need to, you know, comply with his request.
So not only did they go door to door and ask the people living there if they had seen anything or witnessed anything mm-hmm. that evening or since, but they also were requesting to enter the homes and to, you know, casually look around to see if there was anything that was of suspicious nature.
Right.
And the majority of the people seemed to comply with this. It must have been so much of the majority that it almost sounds like, when you read different newspaper accounts of this investigation, uh-huh. that it sounds like everybody was opening their doors. But they do specifically say those who agreed to do such. Another suspect is William Henry Redman. He was a carnival worker who died in 1992. He had a long criminal record for child molestation, this beginning when he was a young boy. But he had been awaiting
13 years old, right?
Yeah. He had been awaiting trial for the 1951 murder of an 8-year-old girl. Her name was Jane Elthop. Now, he had died before they could convict him of this.
Well, but this is where it gets a little sketchy, because he died in 1992.
Correct.
And the murder took place in 51.
Yes.
So it took him a long time to bring this man to trial.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it took a long time. And while he was, you know, he had a cellmate that he had told that he had killed Jane, as well as three other little girls. We should point out, though, that the authorities did question him regarding the Beverly Potts case. This took place in 1988. He did refuse to make a statement either way about her disappearance. He did pass a polygraph in connection to another unsolved disappearance of a girl from Connecticut. But this was a man, as said, he was a carnival worker, so he traveled around.
Right.
And he had given these, you know, these accounts to the cellmate that he had abducted and killed four girls. Now, while awaiting for this trial, the thing here is, the cellmate believes that he had heard that William Henry Redman call, you know, say Beverly's name. Yeah. He couldn't say for certain if it was Beverly Potts, but he believes that the girl that he was describing sounded like Beverly Potts. However, I believe Redman said that he had killed the girl in 1952. So he could have been off, because, you know, he's telling this story years and years later.
Right.
However, he could have simply, unfortunately, killed a different girl at a different location in 1952.
Yeah, I mean, he could get mixed up on the time. I mean, it's not that far off. I mean, month-wise. And again, like I said, he could have abducted this girl. If he's a carnival worker, he's traveling from town to town, he's not going to know who the girl's name is. And yes, you would hear this stuff in your local news, but, you know, this stuff wasn't national news back in 51. You know, a girl went missing in Cleveland, Ohio. They're not bringing it up. There's not Nancy Grace ain't. You know, she's not going to go do 3 months on this missing girl.
Mm-hmm. Now, after William Redman dies, you know, he passes away in 92. He's on trial for the death of this young girl. But things get weirder even after he passes away, you know, because he's suspected of possibly being Beverly Potts' killer. In 1994, a letter was discovered underneath the carpet of a house on Midvale Avenue on the west side of Cleveland. This is near the neighborhood of Beverly Potts. The letter was written in 1960 by a woman who claimed that she had caught her woman disposing of Beverly's body in their furnace. Now, using real estate records, the police identified and tracked down the writer of the letter.
Okay.
Who was at the time 83 when they tracked her down by 1994. Her husband had been passed away for some time. The woman did admit to writing the letter, but she had said that the story was untrue, that she had wrote the story as a, it's listed as a revenge against her husband because he physically abused her for years.
Right.
However, I believe that it was, you know, the long of it is it's not really revenge. I think her abuse might have been so bad,
right,
that maybe she believed he could possibly end up killing her one day.
Mm-hmm.
And had that taken place, maybe she wrote this letter as something to kind of leave lying around for someone to find if she were not around anymore. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I see that, but it's, you know, you look, and I've said it before, and I always get called a feminist. I'm just a dude, man. I'm just the captain. But look, if a guy's hitting you, get out of there. There's plenty of nice guys that want to take care of you, that want to protect you. Get away from those fucking losers. Okay.
No, I agree.
Right, but so I feel for this lady, but at the same time, you're going to bring into this girl's case and this girl's family, and then so yeah, okay. So let's say hypothetically something does happen to you, and so there's this letter lying around and he goes to jail because of this, and there's not much evidence. What is there connecting? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And then this poor family, you know, gets dragged into this thinking that they might get some closure for their missing daughter. You know, protect yourself, stay away from fucking losers. You know, there's plenty of guys out there that will take care of you, but don't drag into a missing girl's family into this.
I agree, but we can also, you know, possibly assume here that if she was willing to go to such extreme lengths to you know, get justice against her husband, you know, for killing her, she thought that he could possibly kill her, that maybe she felt that this situation was one that she was unable to leave or didn't feel safe leaving.
So, but at the end of the day, she says this letter has no truth to it.
Correct. And her husband had been dead for some time at that point. She may have forgotten about this letter because they had to track her down. You know, they found this underneath a rug, mm-hmm, at the home that she once lived. And in 19, I apologize, we're all the way up to the year 2000. And
in
2000, an unidentified individual wrote two letters to the Cleveland Plain Dealer reporter, to a reporter at the Cleveland Plain Dealer. The writer stated that he was dying and he had confessed to molesting and murdering Beverly the night that she had vanished. The letter's author promised that he would turn himself in to the police on August 24th, 2001. This would be the 50th anniversary of Beverly's disappearance.
Wow.
But shortly before this date, a third letter was sent to the Cleveland Plain Dealer. This is saying that he had to go to a nursing home, and thus he was going to not be able to keep his promise revealing his identity or turning himself in. I actually read one of the letters. I was able to find one of the letters. I wish I could have found all three, but I read one, and he basically states that he had lived in the neighborhood.
Okay.
And he had seen her and always been kind of infatuated with her. He, you know, we noted earlier that she was tall, and he said that he thought she was a little bit older. But he was infatuated with her, and when he saw her walking home that night by herself, he saw this as an opportunity for him to take her. And, you know, he says that, "I'm only writing this to you because I'm in my twilight years, that I'm at the end of my life,"
right,
"and that, that he wanted to turn himself in."
Right. And so he felt bad.
I believe he even gave his age as 83 years old. At the time that he wrote that letter, and he stated,
"So what does that put him in 51?"
It
would have been.
He was trying to turn himself in on the 50th anniversary, so that would have put him at about 32.
Okay,
early 30s.
Yeah, so roughly our age.
Her disappearance, and
no, but I'm just saying, like,
yeah,
to get the mental state of where this guy was at. I mean, he's in his 30s. And he has this obsession, or, you know, he says, what was his term?
He said he was infatuated Beverly Potts.
Right, he has an infatuation, but he's 30-some years old and has an infatuation with a 10-year-old. Even if she looks a little older, she's 12.
Right. He had said that he would turn himself in at the park, at Hollerin Park. He was going to go there on the 50th anniversary, and they could arrest him there.
Okay.
And he would confess to the crimes upon that date. And as said, he states that he had to go to a nursing home. I believe that he said that he had got cancer, or his cancer was progressing, and that he needed to go to the nursing home and would be unable to keep his promise turning himself in. Now, the authorities did launch an extensive investigation to identify the author of the letters, but they were never able to ascertain anything beyond that the letters were all written by the same person and right. that their author was probably an elderly, infirm man. Many investigators believe that the correspondence was genuine. Okay. And if I've seen the letters, they're written in cursive with a shaky hand. I don't know that that means that it has to be an old person, but I think that that's what they're basing some of this information off of.
Yes, this is pretty interesting, though. So we have two letters that are basically setting up the, you know, him turning himself in. Then a third letter apologizing. And he was picking the area. He was picking the anniversary. Mm-hmm. Again, stuff that you could just look up off the internet. Again, this could just be, I mean, where do you fall on this? Because, I mean, part of me goes, the gut feeling, some sicko that's just lonely. But if you toss in that this guy might be 80-some years old, do you really think an 80-year-old would just be doing this to get attention?
No,
it seems like it lines up with the idea of I'm coming to my end and I need to confess to this for some kind of forgiveness or remorse. I need to show remorse.
Like a deathbed confession, but I'm going to confess now while I still have all my mental capabilities and I can be honest come clear with this. I don't know. I hate to think that it's a hoax. You would think that after 50 years that you might be able to get an answer. But again, if it's a deathbed confession, you almost think that somebody would carry through with this and turn themselves
right,
in.
Right, right.
So I kind of lean on the side of a hoax.
Yeah, but it could have been as simple as the guy has, you know, my cancer is getting worse, and he talks to somebody. He says, "Yeah, they do take care of you in prison, but the care is going to be very minimal."
Yeah, and this was not the first correspondence that they were receiving. You know, the Cleveland Plain Dealer, they immediately sent the letters to the police. They did not post these in their newspaper.
Well, and this is 2001, so at this point, they're probably even being sent to the FBI.
Yeah, and they didn't put this in their newspaper because they were worried if they put it in the newspaper before the 50th anniversary that the man wouldn't actually turn himself in. So there was no involvement with media other than doing the proper thing by passing along the letters to the police.
Right.
They didn't get involved and then hinder this man from turning himself in. Now, this wouldn't be the first correspondence that investigators had with somebody who claimed to either be the killer or know the killer. Back in I believe it was the 70s, there was a man that came forward that wrote letters. Well, I shouldn't say he came forward, but he had some form of correspondence with the police and said that his brother had done the killing. Now, there was an auto body shop in the neighborhood. Now, keep in mind, this is the 70s, so you're talking about 20 years after the crime.
Right.
But this person had said that the brother did the killing and that the body was buried in the basement. This would have been a home at one time, and that the brother supposedly lived at the home, kidnapped her and killed her and buried her in the basement. Right. Well, they went in the 70s, they went to this body shop and they dug up
good
the concrete
for them. Yeah,
floor
good for them.
And I mean, they went, I think the newspaper said they went 4 feet down, you know, so they went pretty far down before they realized there was nothing there. There was nothing. This was another hoax in this situation. Now, we're not completely
not necessarily a hoax though. I mean, it might, you know, the brother actually might've believed this, you know?
There is some form of hope here though. And I know it sounds crazy because we're talking about, you know, 60 years has passed.
Right.
Over 60 years has passed, and we don't have any answers.
But we still have the letters, so I mean, we can try to do DNA testing, and this guy might have been in the system by then in 2001.
Well, in 2015, somebody had called Crime Stoppers. An anonymous caller called Crime Stoppers and gave some information to Crime Stoppers regarding the disappearance and murder of Beverly Potts. Okay. Now, this is very strange because this is so many years later. Well, what Crime Stoppers did was they actually increased the reward amount that they were offering for information on Beverly Potts. Why? Because when they gave the information to investigators, the investigators made a public plea that, you know, using the newspaper and using news sources, they made a public plea to have the caller please call back, that you can remain anonymous. You can contact us on the website if you like, but we need to hear from you again, because they believed that some of the information they received, they didn't feel like this was a hoax. I don't know what information they received. They didn't say, you know, they weren't outright with information that they received, well, but there was something in there that they were latching onto, and they wanted to hear from this person again, increasing the reward amount. To this date, you know, that was mid 2015. So it's been over a year and we've not heard back from this anonymous person.
Well, and the frustrating thing for true crime fans is, you know, it's an ongoing case. It's an open case. So a lot of times the police department will not, you know, release this information, and that's difficult as a fan of the genre, but we all understand that sometimes I understand it, but sometimes I get a little frustrated because it's like, maybe there is one thing that if you tossed out to the public, it would spark, yeah, you know, some, you know, interest or some conversation or something, and we could solve this case that's been going on for 30 or 60 some years.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's even, you know, for me, at the end of the day, do I have an idea what I think happened? Well, it's hard to think that somebody took her and then raised her as their own, you know, this being so many years later, and we haven't heard anything or any new information come out regarding that. The police did have a very tough investigation. You're not talking about a whole lot of evidence. You know, you're talking about a whole lot of people and not really any eyewitnesses. The thing that I keep going back to over and over again in my head is, who is that plump little lady,
right,
that had her hand on her shoulder? I believe her friend. I believe that this would be such a severe thing for this young child, for this Patricia Swing, to have experienced, that I believe that she would be telling absolutely either the truth or something she believed to be the truth. Maybe she didn't see that, but maybe she thought she saw that.
Right.
But the thing here is, we talked about
and it could have been something as simple as this lady was behind her and the hand wasn't just on the shoulder.
Yeah. Happened to bump into her and just said, "Oh, sorry, honey."
Right,
and
right.
kept walking.
And that was right.
Yeah. But the thing, curious thing here is, the Potts family did say that Beverly would have been weary of men and older boys. And so the police did have a theory that maybe she was enticed by a woman, that a woman could have been involved in the abduction. But as said, there was that tip that came out last year. Hopefully we hear something about this, because this was one of the biggest cases, and it still haunts some of the Cleveland area to this day.
Well, what a great way to start season four. You go back to Ohio.
That's right.
I keep telling people, you're going to get away from Ohio, so people will start visit. You know that our you know, people taking vacations to Ohio has gone down since we started the podcast.
Unfortunately, these things are happening in everywhere. And we happen to cover more Ohio cases because we know of them. But I do want to, I want to throw out a little safety tip here, Captain.
Okay.
Okay. So as our listeners know, we have been involved in the past and will continue to be involved with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. Now, they have something that has recently come out called, it's a safety app. It's a free app to download for iTunes or iPhone and Android devices. Mm-hmm. And it's called Safety Central. So I won't go through the entire bit of it, but I recommend if you have children or if you're a grandparent, that you put this on your phone, and it's basically an identification kit for the children that are special to you, for the children that you know and that you care about. And you're going to be able to put important information about each child on there, as well as a photo. We had discussed earlier, if there is a disappearance of a child, unfortunately, hopefully nobody ever has to experience this. But if you find yourself in this situation, you do not want to lose valuable minutes and hours trying to find these things for the police. Now, thankfully, we live in a digital age, so there's a lot more pictures being taken of people. So,
and not only pictures, but videos now.
Yeah. So it's more commonplace today that you would have an updated photo. But what your ID kit will do, again, this is Safety Central. Get the free app. But what it will do is it will remind you every so often to update the photo of the child
that and you the information on the ID kit. All that stuff.
Yeah. So I recommend checking that out.
And like always, if we get any new information on this case, we'll dive right back into it. And if you know anything, you can contact us at the blog on truecrimegarage.com. And what's this week's recommended reading?
Well, and also, if you want to remain anonymous, you can contact Crime Stoppers. They're looking for information as well. Recommended reading for this week is The Maniac in the Bushes, True Crimes and Disasters from the Streets of Cleveland, and More Tales of Cleveland Woe by John Stark Bellamy II. This is an interesting book. It does talk about the Beverly Potts disappearance. There's lots of photos in here. People like the different photos for the true crime stuff. But there also is the torso killer is covered in this book as well, which has been a case that's been recommended to us about a million times. So if you want to check out more cases from Ohio, specifically the Cleveland area, check out The Maniac in the Bushes by John Stark Bellamy II. And you can do that by going to our website, truecrimegarage.com, and click on the recommended page. And thank you for everybody joining us in the garage this week to help us kick off season 4. We will see you right back here in the garage next week. We're going to do it all over again. We're not taking a break. Make sure you tell a friend, tell 10 friends, and if you have not already, subscribe to the show.
And cheers, mates.
That's right. Until next week, be good, be kind, and don't litter.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.